Well, I was hoping that you would all stay out so late that no one would show up this morning, and I could just go back to bed. I guess I'm talking into this thing. Don't really need this thing, I don't think. Okay, we have these are one-hour classes today, right? Some of them have been an hour and 15 minutes. Okay, so I'll stand up here for the first 45 just to kill time and let you all wake up. I thought I'd give a talk on some of the aspects of the myth of market failure myths. And I keep coming back to recommending students read an essay by Murray Rothbard called Anatomy of the State. It's just one of my favorite Rothbard essays on libertarianism and the role of the state. It's online and it's in several of his books. I think it's in The Ethics of Liberty, if you want a hard copy and get that. But one of the points that Rothbard makes is that no state can survive unless it has some sort of ideology and a group of court historians who promote that ideology. And the ideology is usually some sort of glorification of the state and its minions, coupled with an attack of the civil society, the free enterprise system, private property. That has to be demonized, and at the same time, the state and the people who comprise the state have to be propped up as heroic and omniscient and caring and so forth. And so, but once that falls, once that facade goes away, no state can remain in power. Even a totalitarian state like the Soviet Union, Rothbard argued, ultimately relies on fooling the people into thinking that freedom and independence are a bad thing and that taxes and war and slavery are a good thing. And so I recommend that article to everybody. And a lot of what I've done in my research over the years has been trying to look pretty closely into both sides of this myth. That's why I've written several books on Lincoln and Hamilton and things like that, because the myths surrounding Abraham Lincoln really are the ideological cornerstone of the American state, and why it is supposed to be sacrosanct. And at the same time, there are a lot of myths, market failure myths, and, too many to count. I'm going to try to fit in maybe three or four of what I consider to be some of the biggest ones in the economics profession. Where to start? I think in my other lecture, I mentioned something called the Nirvana fallacy. This is a phrase I think was coined by Harold Demsetz. In an article in the Journal of Law and Economics around 1970, Demsetz was a UCLA economist. He's a Chicago School economist, not an Austrian, but I would call him a fellow traveler of the Austrians. He knew Hayek, and he probably knew von Mises, too, in his day, because of his association with the Mont Pelerin Society that they belonged to. Of course, what the Nirvana fallacy is a critique of the mainstream way of looking at market failure, of setting up this utopian ideal of perfectly competitive equilibrium, and then comparing the real world to that and complaining that the real world doesn't meet the perfectionist ideal of perfect competition. And of course, nothing does. Nothing on earth is perfect. And so it really has been the one big straw man argument, as far as I'm concerned. Economists didn't always accept this perfect competition model as the benchmark for competition. This only came about around the 1930s that they really accepted. And so, of course, you could find market failure everywhere if you don't have homogeneous products and prices and costless entry and exit and perfect information. All these assumptions are assumed to be what markets are like. That's why you have people like Paul Krugman every once in a while just perpetually criticizing everything that goes on in markets, because they'll say, well, after all, yeah, I'm for markets, I'm for using capitalism, but and then there are all these flaws I've always thought it was really a dishonest way of going about economic analysis as far as that's concerned, because they don't use the same criterion to judge government. you know, Pareto optimality is used as to judge markets, and if the government, if markets are not Pareto optimal, they fail. Well, why don't we use the same thing when we analyze what government does? Is, you know, how Pareto optimal would government be? The failures would be many orders of magnitude worse than anything that ever goes on in markets if you use the same standard, if economists use the same standard. And so that's just sort of an opening commentary there. I think the title of Demsetz's article is Information and Efficiency, Another View. It was in the Journal of Law and Economics 69 or 70, a long, long time ago, but it's considered to be a classic, I think, by a lot of Austrians. Israel Kirzner elaborates on it in his book, Competition and Entrepreneurship. And so if you're interested in the whole area of market failure, this is one article you should read at some point, I would think. And so a number of things I'm going to talk about is antitrust, so-called natural monopoly, asymmetric information as a source of market failure, supposedly, and if we have time, path dependence, so-called path dependence. And so maybe I'll write these down as categories of alleged market failure. Peter Klein may have spoken about path dependence a little bit, but probably in a different way than I do. But take antitrust, first of all. And as a lot of you know, I like to combine theory and history, which is the topic of one of Mises' books. And, you know, I was an economics major in college, and I got a PhD, and I was working at George Mason at the time in the 80s, and I started doing research in this area, antitrust regulation, the economics of antitrust, and it struck me that the standard story in all the books is that in America in the late 19th century, there was a merger wave that created what some authors have called rampant cartelization, rampant monopolization of the American economy. And so the markets were failing. Monopoly was propping up everywhere. And so government rode in on a white horse and saved the day, saved the consumers from these rapacious monopolists by enacting the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. That's the standard story. It's in all the books. It's in any textbook in microeconomics that mentions antitrust. You have some rendition of that story that the markets were failing in the context of monopoly. Okay. Well, at the time, you know, after being going through an undergraduate program in economics, graduate school, I'm out, you know, researching and publishing at George Mason, it struck me that I had never seen any actual evidence that this was actually occurring. That, you know, because one thing that I did know was that this period of history was a period of price deflation. The whole post-Civil War era in the United States was a period of price deflation. Primarily because of the what is known as the Second Industrial Revolution. There was a very rapid expansion of production. So supply is booming in the economy, and it's dropping prices everywhere. And so it always seemed odd to me that the economic historians would say, oh, yes, this was like for 30 years, prices went down and down and down and down, but there was also rampant monopolization. Well, that should at least cause you to question this whole story about antitrust. It doesn't prove that the antitrust story is false, but there's, you know, someone like me smells a rat. That's pretty much what my career has been. It's been sort of smelling out rat holes that created by the state and its apologists. And so in a nutshell, what I did was I dug up the data, what data there were on production levels of the industries that were accused of being monopolies. How I got my first piece of information, I had a research assistant read through the congressional record, 1889 and 1890, and just write down all the industries that were being accused of being monopolies. And this included lead, zinc, even castor oil, matches, steel rails, all things like this. There'd be some politician would stand up in the House of Representatives and berate the castor oil industry for being monopolistic, or the match industry, or something like that. So we wrote these all down. Okay, these are the trusts that are being targeted by the Sherman antitrust law. And so then we got what data were available. There's a publication called Historical Statistics of the United States that had a lot of it. And one of the things we found is we got the data for the 10 years prior to the Sherman Act, 1880 to 1890, and then 10 years after also to see what was happening. And basically what we saw was that in the 10 years prior to the Sherman Antitrust Act, real GDP in the United States increased by 24%. This was called the Second Industrial Revolution. The U.S. economy was growing very rapidly once the Civil War was over and there was free labor everywhere, and that helped a lot. And the cost of the war had been pretty much sunk. But on the industries that are accused of being monopolies, they grew on average by 175%. So you had the economy growing pretty good, 24% during a decade, but the industries that were accused of being monopolies were growing at 175%. And so according to the mainstream definition of what a monopoly does, what does it do? It restricts output to drive up prices. It's ludicrous to think that they were not restricting output. And I've had some critics saying, well, yeah, well, it might have been 700% had they not monopolized these industries instead of what it was. Right. And elephants might fly out of my ears someday, too. So they were increasing output several times faster than the economy as a whole, which itself was booming. And as I said, this was also a period of price deflation. And the price level, what data we have, the price level fell by about 7% from 1880 to 1890. But the price of these items, the products that were being sold as being monopolistic, fell even faster. Some of them were like 53%, 58% were falling much faster than the CPI was falling during that time. So you had extraordinarily rapid growth in production. Not only that, but you had these trusts were inventing newer products. John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company invented literally hundreds of new products in the whole process of going about getting oil out of the ground and bringing it to market as refined kerosene and things like that. They invented Vaseline and all sorts of other byproducts that came out, all the chemists that they employed. And so not only did you have an increase in output, but you had a big expansion in the variety of products that were available in the markets. So you had hyper competition occurring here. And at the same time, you had calls for the need to do something about this monopoly problem, which is very odd. And of course, on the face of it, it seems very odd. But really, it's the same old story that any kind of legislation normally has some sort of special interest group behind it. Congress does at times just come out with its own rules and regulations and laws, but almost always, if you want to know who benefits from legislation, look for who lobbied for it. That's a good rule of thumb. Find out who lobbied for it. If you want to know who the beneficiaries of a particular piece of special interest legislation are, that's what you do. And of course, the main proponents of this were the sour grape competitors of the big trusts who were either unwilling or unable to drop their prices. One of the earliest ones was the beef trust. There was talk of the beef trust, where the big four meat packers, Armour and Swift and companies like that, centralized beef, the butchering of cattle in Chicago. And Chicago, by that time, was a big rail hub. And so it was all the butchering and the dressing of the beef was all done in and around Chicago. Then there were trains that would take the dressed beef all over the country. So all of a sudden, the mom-and-pop monopoly butcher shop in town, which is selling beef for $5 a pound, has competition selling beef for $1 a pound. They didn't like that. And so they recruited originally a senator from Missouri named Senator Vest, as in vest, like Tom Woods wears, vest, V-E-S-T, to have a commission. They had the Vest Commission in the United States Senate, and to look into this problem of the declining price of beef. Declining price, not the high price of beef. One of my favorite sayings over the whole historical debate on protectionism was from John C. Calhoun, the former American vice president. He was a free trader. And on the floor of the Senate, he once said, protectionism, protection from what? Protection from low prices. That's what they want to protect us from, the protectionists, protect us from low prices. Well, that's exactly what was going on here. So the Vest Commission was in the 1887, 1888. So this was a couple years before the federal law was passed. But there were state antitrust laws that were passed before that, including one in Missouri where Senator Vest was from. And so the whole problem was centered around the issue of what to do to prop up beef prices. And the similar things happened in other industries, as steel rails and so forth. They wanted a law that would do that. They didn't know that the law would do that. They wanted Congress to do something to put an end to this all this competition. And so they did. They passed the Sherman Antitrust Act to do just that. And so the evidence clearly contradicts the standard story that there was monopolization occurring. In fact, the antitrust law, the original antitrust law, was an attempt to quell competition, to slow it down or stop competition. Although it didn't do much in the first 10 or 15 years. They didn't have very many lawsuits that they brought in the first 10 or 15 years. And I published a number of articles on this. The original one was called The Origins of Antitrust. It was in the International Review of Law and Economics way back in 1984. And then I co-authored an article with Donald Boudreau on called Antitrust Before the Sherman Act. And it was in the Review of Austrian Economics a couple years after that. And so that's where we documented all this. Another thing I did in this research project was the famous muckraking journalists wrote a lot about the trusts. And so I thought, well, let's see what, right from the horse's mouth, what the muckraking journalists at the New York Times were saying about the Sherman Antitrust Act. And it turns out that I found out that the New York Times was against it. They came out against the Sherman Antitrust Act. And I won't read you the quote. I'll just paraphrase what they said. They were originally for it. They thought, yeah, these trusts, we don't trust these big companies. And it was just bigness that they didn't like. But then after observing what was going on, they switched and they became anti-antitrust. And the reason, the thing that really convinced them was that Senator John Sherman, put his name on the Sherman Antitrust Act. And that was June of 1890. July of 1890. And then in October of 1890, Sherman was, as chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, sponsored the McKinley Tariff Bill, which at the time was the biggest tariff increase in American history. So you have the same guy who supposedly was protecting consumers from high prices in July, sponsoring the biggest tariff increase in American history in October. The same thing. And so the New York Times editorialists observed this, and they came to the conclusion that the Sherman Act was just a political fig leaf designed to fool the public into thinking that the Republican Party was doing something about monopoly, while at the same time, they were the creators of monopoly. And they always had been. You know, the protectionist tariffs was the cornerstone of the Republican Party platform of 1860. When Abe Lincoln ran for president, his campaign poster had pictures of him and here's his campaign poster. It had pictures of him and Hannibal Hamlin. See, here's Abe Lincoln. Some devil's horns on him. Here's Hannibal Hamlin, his vice president. Human nose. And the slogan was, oh, yeah, he wore a top hat, didn't he? Give him the hat. Yeah. Protection for home industry. Protection for Home Industry was literally the campaign poster when Abe Lincoln ran for president. And so the Republican Party was always the party of the plutocracy from the very beginning, and how they intended to benefit the plutocracy, their beneficiaries as politicians, was protectionist tariffs and corporate welfare funded by a national bank. They wanted that. And they did get the corporate welfare in terms of the massive subsidies to the railroads. But the average tariff rate during the Civil War went up to close to 50%. It averaged 15% in 1857, 15%. But it was pushed up to 48% during the war, and it stayed there more or less until 1913, when the income tax came into being. And the McKinley Tariff Bill of 1890 was just one of the dozens of tariff increases that the Republican Party championed. And so it was no secret that the Republican Party was the champion of screwing over the consumer for the benefit of big business. That's what they were all about always. And so here you have Senator Sherman, who, by the way, was also in the Senate, on the Senate Finance Committee during the Civil War. So he's still there. You know, you can never get rid of these guys. They're like venereal disease. You know, once you got it, they're there forever. You know, like syphilis or something. Maybe politicians. And so he's still there, and he's still raising taxes. You know, they started raising taxes, tariff tax. There was no income tax at this time. And so he pretty much spent his whole career devoted to raising taxes as much as possible. So the New York Times concluded that this was just all a fig leaf designed to fool the public into thinking that the Republican Party is the party of the little guy and is going to protect us from the rapacious monopolists, when exactly the opposite is true. And I think the New York Times got the story exactly right. I think that's exactly what was going on. And then, another article of mine that was published in Economic Inquiry, co-authored with Jack High, was called Antitrust and Competition Historically Considered. We looked at the views of economists. You know, what were the economists saying about this? The economics profession was almost unanimously opposed to antitrust regulation in 1890 as a matter of principle. They thought blocking mergers or breaking up bigger companies was inherently incompatible with the competitive process. And they didn't come to embrace and start making excuses for this until the 1930s, really. And so the late George Stigler wrote an article about this, about why economists came to accept antitrust regulation when they were all against it at the beginning. And his explanation was they learned that they could make more than the minimum wage as antitrust consultants. That's what Stigler said. Jack High and I argued that their theory of competition changed from the sort of Austrian theory of competition as a dynamic process to perfect competition, which requires many firms. So you don't have to badmouth them as greedy liars like Stigler did. You could just blame them for having a faulty theory of competition, which caused them to change their mind. So that's what I want to say about antitrust. The second myth that I've taken a look at is the so-called natural monopoly myth. And those of you who've ever taken a course in microeconomics were taught that in the public utility industries like electricity, natural gas, telephone services, and so forth, there were economies of scale because of the heavy fixed cost. Here's my Abe Lincoln picture. If anyone wants this picture of Abe Lincoln, you can feel free. I'll autograph it for you. Come and take it. So the standard story is that these are industries that have economies of scale, long run average cost. Looks something like this: output, price, cost. And the standard story is that, well, in some of these industries, you'll get one company that'll be the first to achieve this very low average cost. And it will therefore be able to underprice everybody else and become a monopoly. But that's not such a bad thing, because at that level of output here, they do have a low. Oops. I guess we're not seeing the whole thing. What's that?
You can zoom it out.
Where's the zoom at? Let's see. The other way. It Let's see how Abe Lincoln looks like that. He's a little smaller than that. That's Lincoln and Hannibal Hamlin there. That's their official campaign poster. I guess Lincoln should have a gun in his hand, too. With some bullets, a machine gun. You know, it's a kind of a machine gun. Okay. So anyway, so you have this low cost per unit, and the standard story is that, this is a good thing if you have low cost of producing electricity and natural gas, but if you have a monopoly, they'll charge some sort of monopolistic price up here. Therefore, government should come in and create a monopoly. It should, by law, give this company a monopoly, but then regulate the price so that it's somewhere in the middle here, you know. So we'll call this the fair price. Fair price. I'm not going to mess with details of marginal costs and all that, but that's the basic idea. We want monopoly because it gives us economies of scale, but we don't want monopoly pricing. We want something where these companies can make enough money so that they profit and they can reinvest some of it in more power lines and more telephone poles and things like that. That's the idea. Okay. And so if it weren't for government to step in and create monopoly, we would have monopoly, is the story. And that always sounded kind of fishy to me, too. If it weren't for government creating a monopoly, we would have monopoly. Once again, this is a complete myth. Never happened like that. You know, this, after all, this is all a story. Real history didn't work out like this. I'm going to quote Harold Demsetz again, of all people. I'm not even a student of Demsetz or anything. He just happens to have done a lot of research in his career on natural monopolies. And here's something he pointed out in one of his articles about, you know, was it true that there was sort of this evolution toward one's big firm dominating electric power in city by city, natural gas? He said this: six electric light companies were organized in 1 year in 1887 in New York City. 45 electric light enterprises had the legal right to operate in Chicago in 1907. Prior to 1895, Duluth, Minnesota was served by five electric light companies. Scranton, Pennsylvania had four. During the latter part of the 19th century, competition was the usual situation in the gas industry. Before 1884, six competing companies were operating in New York City. Competition was common and especially persistent in the telephone industry. Baltimore, Chicago, Cleveland, Columbus, Detroit, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis had at least two telephone companies in 1905. And so it never actually happened. We never actually saw a natural monopoly evolving on the free market via this story. The government stepped in and created these monopolies, and then economists invented this theory after the fact. This theory came after this all happened. And here, I'll explain to you how a monopoly did come into being. In the course of some of my research, I ran across a book. Let's see, where is it? I was in Maryland at the time. And I ran across a book that was a history of what today is called the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company. It was called the Baltimore Gas Company, Consolidated Gas Company, back then, late 19th century. And this was a book published by Johns Hopkins University Press. And the reason why this is relevant, this book of all the books, is that Richard T. Ely, the co-founder of the American Economic Association, was teaching at Johns Hopkins at the time, and he had written a whole bunch of articles on the whole electric power industry issue in magazines and academic journal articles, and so he was sort of the leading academic expert of the day on this. And this book, The Gaslight Company of Baltimore, relies heavily on Ely's writings and research, and it was published by Johns Hopkins Press, where he was probably the reviewer of the book, since he was on the faculty at Johns Hopkins at the time. The author is not Ely, it's somebody else, but here's the name, George Brown. But here's what it said: when monopoly did appear in these industries, here's how it happened. I'm quoting, in 1890, a bill was introduced into the Maryland legislature that called for an annual payment to the city from the Consolidated Gas Company of $10,000 a year and 3% of all dividends declared in return for the privilege of enjoying a 25-year monopoly. And so this was always a form of tax collection. We'll create a monopoly, and so and since you have a monopoly, there'll be plenty of profits. We'll be able to fleece the customers pretty well. We've got a government-run monopoly. You know, not a private monopoly, a government-sponsored monopoly, and we will share the loot. You know, you, the company, will make monopoly profits, and of course, you know, you'll have to share some of that in terms of financing our political careers. The city councils and the state politicians are saying, you know, campaign contributions, as they are euphemistically called, and you'll give us $10,000 a year and 3% of your dividends. You know, as a tax, you know, so it's literally as an implicit, a hidden tax on the customers who are paying the bills, the electric bills there. And that is how this got started in city after city after city in the United States. It was a sort of a share the loot scheme between local governments and these companies that did try to form cartels, but cartels always break down. And so they gave up trying to form private cartels, and they decided to get government to use the coercive powers of the state to create their monopoly for them. And it didn't happen everywhere. There's an economist named Walter Primo. Spell this how he spells his name. Primo. He wrote a book called Direct Utility Competition. And I can remember when I was in graduate school reading all of Primo's articles in the Review of Economics and Statistics and places like that, and he put them all into this book, and he found that historically there were several dozen cities in America that didn't go this route, that allowed direct competition in a city. And direct competition means that you have a city. Here's my map of Auburn. Here's Auburn, Alabama. Direct competition means two companies competing for everybody in Auburn. It doesn't mean Company A gets the left side of Auburn and Company B gets the right side of Auburn. No, they competed for the whole city. Who, you know, whoever could provide the best deal, you hook up with them. And so Primo found that there were about two dozen cities in America that just didn't establish government-sponsored monopolies. They used property taxes to fund their stuff. They didn't use property tax, and in addition, the taxation of the electric power company to raise their revenue. And sure enough, in this long series of econometric articles in the Review of Econometrica and your Review of Economics and Statistics and places like that, it came to the conclusion that where there's competition, prices tend to be lower and service is better. And who would ever have thought that that would be the case? And the same thing has been true everywhere else. The phone company, the government nationalized the telephone industry during World War I. And then after the war was over, it did not denationalize. It gave each state, the federal government allowed each state to set up its own monopoly with AT&T long-distance phone service. So the AT&T monopoly was set up by an arrangement between the federal government and the state and the governors and the legislatures of the states to create a telephone monopoly until it was finally broken up by companies like MCI in the 1980s. So this lasted from the 1920s to the 1980s, but it was a creature of government regulation, is what it was, which as was the monopoly in the airline industry. The Civil Aeronautics Board cartelized the airline industry. The Interstate Commerce Commission cartelized the trucking industry for decades. The Fed cartelized the banking industry. This is what happened in the early 20th century. The creation of the Fed was all a part of this public utility scheme way of thinking that monopoly is a good thing. We need monopoly. We need cartels as long as they're run by the government. That's essentially, you know, in Hayek's famous book, The Road to Serfdom, he makes a very big deal in chapter after chapter about the monopoly of his day, and it was so-called natural monopoly. That's one of the things he complains about in three or four chapters in The Road to Serfdom. It's not just totalitarianism and Nazism and Mussolini and fascism that he writes about in The Road to Serfdom. It's government-created monopoly is also a big threat to freedom in Friedrich Hayek's view in his famous book, The Road to Serfdom. So that's how monopoly appeared. And so again, so that's myth number two, market failure myth number two, the myth of natural monopoly. Market failure myth number three, I guess I'll mention path dependence. This was a this came about. There's an economist named Paul David, whose name is associated with this. He used to be at the University of Tennessee. I think he still is. And I heard him give a talk once, where he claimed that the reason why there were gasoline shortages in the 1970s was not price controls. It was the fact that some state governments imposed even odd license plate number rationing schemes. That's what created the shortages. The shortages had nothing to do with price controls. So at the time, I thought, this guy's an economist. He doesn't know that price ceilings cause shortages. What kind of economist is that? Well, then I learned he's a Keynesian. Well, of course, he doesn't know anything about economics. He's a Keynesian. He's a well-known. He was one of the guys that started after Keynesianism was pretty much abandoned by the economics profession in the 1970s because of stagflation. It had no explanation for stagflation. And so the Keynesians started calling themselves post-Keynesians. But it meant the same thing. You know, here's what a Keynesian looks like. I'll draw, since I'm pretty good at art. Here's a Keynesian. Here's a post-Keynesian. Okay, so as you can see, the difference between the two there. But anyway, Paul David, one of his academic articles, he came up with he discovered a new market failure that no one had uncovered yet. And it came to be labeled as path dependence. The idea is that there are certain technologies that consumers kind of like and they adopt as products. And they lock in. They're said to lock in these technologies, even though there might be a superior technology out there. And the example he gave was originally was the QWERTY keyboard. Anybody recognize this QWERTY? That's the keyboard. That's the keys on your computer. And so the story was that Davidson told was that well there is a there is another type of keyboard called the Dvorak keyboard, and it's those are not the letters. That's a man's name, but it's a different configuration of letters on a keyboard, a typewriter keyboard at this time. And so the story was, everybody adopted the IBM Selectric typewriter and has this QWERTY keyboard, and even though it's inferior technology to the Dvorak keyboard, and there are studies showing it's inferior technology to the Dvorak keyboard. And so he's saying, the free market often locks in inferior technologies as a result, and so the government needs to regulate standards like this. The government needs to tell us what our typewriters look like and things like that. You can't allow the free market. The free market meaning consumers. I mean, that's how this was chosen. The consumers kind of like this. It works well. We buy it and we lock it in. Okay, so-called. Well, as it turns out, this is another myth because when some people started looking into it, especially one economist who did a real good job of this is Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis. And there's a great book that talks about this whole issue of theirs. It's called Winners, Losers, and Microsoft. And it's by Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis. And what they found was that Dvorak, they looked at it, well, where's this Dvorak keyboard come from anyway? And it comes from a naval officer during World War II named Dvorak, and that's a Czech name. He's a Czech American. And Dvorak had a patent on this keyboard. And the research that Paul David relied on was Dvorak got like the two secretaries who worked for him in the Navy to type things with the QWERTY keyboard and his keyboard, and then he decided that his keyboard was better. That would be like Coca-Cola organizing a taste test between Coke and Pepsi and declaring Coke is better. Okay, don't buy Pepsi. Coke is better. Not only don't buy Pepsi, don't allow anyone else to buy Pepsi. You know, lock in Coke, and so that sort of destroyed the credibility of the argument there. And then these guys, Margolis and Leibowitz, hired people to do their own studies. They hired people, you know, professional typists to do this, and they found there's really not much of a significant difference at all. And then, and of course, the economics of this is that, you know, if it's even if the Dvorak was a little bit better, well, consumers will make that decision for themselves. If it's enough of an improvement and it makes your life that much better, well, people will dump the old system and adopt the new one. It's kind of like people who switch to Apple computers. You know, if you're convinced that it is that much of an improvement over the way you've been working with your Microsoft computer, you'll switch, and a lot of people switch. You know, Lou Rockwell is a huge devotee of Apple, and he loves Apple computers, and a lot of people have done that. But in this case, there wasn't that much of a difference, so it wouldn't be worth it to dump your old computer, typewriter or computer, and spend thousands of dollars on a new equipment for a, you know, minuscule possible benefit there. And so I argue also that the real path dependence that locks in inferior technologies is government. You know, think about government. Think of patents on pharmaceuticals. You know, who knows what superior pharmaceuticals might have come into being if you didn't have a 20-year patent on the medicine for this ailment. And if there had been 20 years of research and development by hundreds of companies that could have created another, you know, a better thing. Look at how the public schools have locked in the technology of education. I mean, the school buses look the same as they did in the 1920s, for God's sake. The post office, look at that dinky little truck they deliver the mail in. It's the same dinky little truck that existed when I was 5 years old. That's really the best way to, none at all. The air traffic controllers, only just a couple of years ago, quit using vacuum tubes to do the air traffic. I mean, we got rid of vacuum tubes in televisions in the 1950s. And so talk about it, locking in inferior technology. That's where the inferior technology is locked in, is government. Because once a technology is chosen and put into place by government, it automatically puts together a collection of interest groups who profit from that who sell that technology, profit from it, and they will become a lobbying force to make sure that no other technology competes with them. And so it'll be very, it won't be impossible, but it'll be very difficult to switch technologies once that happens. You probably have read stories of how a lot of what the Pentagon buys is just grossly outdated Air Force jets, weaponry, and so forth. Why do they do that? Why do they spend billions on this outdated stuff that the Chinese would laugh at, for example? Is that, well, there are powerful special interests who make many billions of dollars selling the government this old crap, which they have been selling them for 30 years, and they like it. They kind of like making that money, and the politicians like having their careers supported by these companies. And so that's what they do. They lock in the bad technology for military purposes and for everything else. And this could be a whole book topic of a sort of, path dependence ass backwards is sort of the title I have in mind. Because it seems to me that it's all backwards. It's a government that creates, locks in bad technologies, not the free market. It's the free market that topples these things. It was the Microsoft Corporation that toppled IBM. IBM was of the opinion that no one would be interested in personal computers at the beginning. Their business was the big giant mainframes. You know, when I was a college student and I took computer science, the computer was about half the size of this room. And it probably did not have anywhere, it probably had 1/100,000th the power of this iPad this guy here has on his desk at the time. You know, it's like, you know, it's like comparing an ant to an elephant with today's technology. That's what IBM thought was the future, was computing on those things. And it really was just a step above pounding on a stone tablet. I can remember being in graduate school and taking econometrics, and you had to type in all your data on these cardboard cards. One at a time, all the data, and then you had to get the cards and feed them into a card reader. And the thing, you know, the air rushed them through, and it come flipping out, and it was really kind of like stone tablet days, and that's what IBM thought was the best possible technology, which is why Microsoft cleaned their clock, and then IBM was losing $400 million a day at one point, right when Microsoft was at its sort of peak of market busting, when it was really became prominent. In the early 1980s. Okay, so that's what I'll have to say about that myth. The final myth I want to talk about is the myth of asymmetric information as a source of market failure. Let's call it asymmetric info. And the original article here, I think, was an article in the American Economic Review called "The Lemons Problem." Lemons, as though, you know, the lemon that you put in your drink. And the author was an economist named Akerlof, Bruce Akerlof, and Harvard guys. Of course, that's where all these bad ideas come from. Ultimately, either Harvard economists or their students, or Princeton and MIT too. They're pretty bad, but. Akerlof predicted that the used car market would possibly just disappear. There wouldn't be no used car market. He predicted that it would just dwindle and get smaller and smaller and smaller, and maybe even just disappear. There wouldn't be a used car market at all because of the asymmetric information problem, because the seller of the car has more information about what kind of a car it is than the buyer does. And so, therefore, people never know if they're going to be sold a lemon or not, you know, lemon being a bad product. And so because of all the uncertainty involved, he said there's a market failure problem here that people haven't recognized before, and that the sellers of products have superior information compared to the buyers of products. And it was not just the used car market. He meant this to be pretty general for markets in general, not just – he just used cars as his – is his chief example in his article. Okay, and so it's that's what asymmetric, you know, which means unequal information was. And of course, at the time Akerlof wrote the article, the free market had already solved the lemons problem with product warranties. A product warranty eliminates the lemons problem. You know, if you get a car and it's a lemon, and you have a 30-day warranty, that's plenty of time to have a mechanic check out your car, drive it around, find out if it's a lemon or not. Then you have companies also, you know, today you have companies like CarMax. They have a guarantee. I've bought and sold several cars through CarMax. They used to have, it's been a few years now, but they used to have a 7-day, no questions asked guarantee. As long as you don't do what the guys in that movie Jackass do and get the car and go out and wreck it and then bring it back, they'll give you every penny back, no questions asked. And so that's plenty of time to have your car checked out. And so product warranties pretty much eliminated the risk of buying a lemon out there. And that they existed when Akerlof wrote the article, but he just sort of pretended that it didn't. And Joseph Stiglitz, another MIT-trained economist, he's written hundreds of articles about on every angle of this, and sort of never mentions the fact that product warranties can take care of these issues of buying lemons. Not to mention competition. You know, there's competition in the used car market. So if you are a dishonest car dealer, well, it's not like you're not going to stay in business that long if there's competition, because people will catch on. Your brand name will be, Lemon Cars. And so no one will go and buy your Lemon Cars. They'll go and buy cars from CarMax. The people that say 30-day warranty on everything, bring it back in 7 days, we'll give you every penny back, we won't ask any questions as long as you don't wreck it. Why would anyone even consider going to Lemon Cars if they could have alternatives like that? And so this, you know, you get a Nobel Prize winner like Stiglitz, who doesn't seem to understand competition at all. And this doesn't mean that there are never any dishonest people out there. There are. But markets penalize dishonesty if there's competition, okay, and that's how the system works. So it's not quite the catastrophic failure that he would think. And think and ask yourself this question, as far as asymmetric information goes, and maybe I'll quote myself here. Who knows more about building houses? You or home builders who do it for a living? Who knows more about supplying grocery stores with fresh meat? Ranchers and farmers or you? Who knows more about manufacturing automobiles? Automotive engineers who work for automobile companies or you? The customer, you know, who knows more about producing and marketing articles of clothing, clothing manufacturers and distributors, or you, the shopper? You know, everything in the economy exhibits asymmetric information. The people who work to produce things, of course, know more about this than the people who buy them. There's another word, a better word for this than asymmetric information. It's called the division of labor. Okay, you know, what is the division of labor about? It's, you know, we all specialize in something, and we naturally know more about that something that we specialize in than people who do not specialize in that something. And we produce and sell this thing, and we get money, and we buy them, and we use the money to buy things from other people who specialize in other things. And of course, they have superior information than we do about these other things because they specialize in making them. We don't. Okay? And so it's asymmetric information, if you will, which I prefer to think of as the division of labor. Not only the division of labor, the division of labor and knowledge in society that makes markets work. It's not what makes markets fail. That's how markets work. That's why trade takes place. We have different information. And Mises and Hayek totally understood this. I can give you a few quotes. Mises called the division of labor the fundamental social phenomenon along with human cooperation. He said, cooperative action is more productive and efficient than self-sufficient individuals because of several facts. The innate inequality of all human beings with regard to their abilities in the workplace, the unequal distribution of nature-given non-human opportunities of production on the surface of the earth, and the fact that almost all production processes require some kind of teamwork so that no single person could accomplish them. So that's the International Division of Labor. Hayek wrote something similar to this. Now, Mises was writing during the machine age, so he used division of labor. But Hayek was always, the use of information in society is probably his most famous article. And so he was talking in a lot of his career about the division of knowledge in the minds of people, a lot more than labor, you know, with the information age. He was really a precursor of the thinking of the information age. And here's what he said in one of the things in his article, famous article, The Use of Knowledge in Society. Hayek said, "We need to remember only how much we have to learn in any occupation after we have completed our theoretical training, how big a part of our working life we spend learning particular jobs, and how valuable an asset in all walks of life is knowledge of people, of local conditions, and of special circumstances. The shipper who earns his living from using otherwise empty or half-filled journeys of tramp steamers, or the estate agent whose whole knowledge is almost exclusively one of temporary opportunities, or the arbitrageur who gains from local differences of commodity prices, are all performing eminently useful functions based on special knowledge of circumstances of the fleeting moment not known to others." That's asymmetric information he's talking about. And so he's saying this is what makes markets work, the international division of knowledge and specialization. It's not what makes markets fail, but that's what Akerlof and Stiglitz and the market failure theorists are trying to say. And so once again, they've got it ass backwards, to use the scientific term for the type of analysis. Okay, and of course, once again, in an article of mine that I wrote about this, the final section is called The Real Asymmetric Information Problem. The Real Asymmetric Information Problem. And you could probably guess where this is. Well, think about this, about the prosecution of wars. Who has more information about what's likely to happen with Syria and Iraq right now? You or maybe the dozen or so people in the State Department and the executive branch of the U.S. government who have been conniving and manipulating and lying and scheming for war for the past 4 or 5 years. You know, who has more information about what's going to happen in foreign policy, you or the foreign policy establishment? And then ask yourself the same question about any policy, environmental policy, tax policy, spending policy, healthcare policy. Who knows more about that, you or the bureaucrats who are writing all the legislation and the regulation, you or the congressional staffers who are writing the laws for their bosses in Congress? Of course, the answer is there's a massive difference in the amount of information there that exists, and it's a whole different world than the marketplace. Okay, the government uses this what public choice economists call rational ignorance to sort of snow over us to do whatever they want because of the fact that we could never ever possibly understand what they're up to. It's not like in the market where we all just specialize with the purpose of benefiting one another. That's not what government is about. It's not about mutually advantageous trade like the market. It's about one gang plundering another gang, a smaller gang, if you will. And so that's, once again, I think, where the real asymmetric information problem is between the citizens and the government. The government has far superior information about what it is up to, and that leads, the bigger is that gap, the more tyrannical the government will be. That, by the way, is why for centuries, those of the classical liberal persuasion have always advocated decentralization in terms of government, because the knowledge was always that the closer government is to the people, the more likely it is we'll be able to find out more about what they're up to, keep an eye on them, and control them. The farther away from the people, the less likely we can control them. Okay, and the farther away they are, meaning like Washington, D.C., the more likely there's a giant gap between what we know about what government is doing and what they're actually doing. That's one of the reasons why Europe became prosperous is the proliferation of dozens and dozens of city-states, where if one was especially tyrannical, you could vote with your feet and move somewhere else. So decentralization of government has always been linked to this idea that it's easier to control government, but it's based partly on this idea that that government always has an uneven advantage in terms of knowledge of what it's up to, what it's scheming to do. And the people, if they have any hope of not being victims of tyranny, have to discipline them in that way. Okay, it hasn't worked out too well for us, though, in this country, as far as that goes. Okay, that's. I see my time is almost up, although we have a couple minutes for if anybody has a question or a brilliant declaration or something like that. So you want to give me money, that's fine. That's, okay.
I have a question about asymmetric information. Do you have any comments on insider trading? Because it's I could argue with that is like government intervention. They don't do perfect jobs, but at least they narrow down the rules of insider trading.
Well, first of all, the government does not have a definition of insider trading. So this is a classic definition of something where traders can be thrown in prison on a whim because no one knows what it is. There is no legal definition of it. What insider trading does is it quickens the time at which information that investors can use gets on the market and become used by everyone. So if you're an insider and you have information and you act on that information, other people will be watching you and they will say, well, he's an insider. He must know what he's doing. I'm going to buy also. And so if he didn't do that, it would be slower. It would take more time for you to act as an investor on the market based on the information. So you and I sort of free ride on the insiders and their information if we're active investors. And so I think that's basically what it does is make the stock market work faster as far as that goes. But everybody has insider information. If you're You know, if you work, if you're work inside the car industry, you have more information than I do. I don't work inside the car industry. If you work in the grape industry, you have more information about the grape crop next year than I do. I don't pay any attention to the grape crop except for when I'm drinking wine. You know, and so yeah, everybody has insider information. And so, you know, why should the government step in? The real problem, as I see it, is that the type of insider information is, I don't know if you've read about this in recent years, is that the members of Congress are real bold about this now, knowing that there is going to be a vote at 2 o'clock this afternoon on some law that will have a positive or negative effect on Industry X, and they will call their stockbroker to buy or sell stock in Industry X because they will have insider information knowing exactly what's going to happen, but you and I don't. You know, they know what the vote's going to be. The votes are all counted by the majority whip and the minority whip, so they know in advance exactly what's going to happen. But you and I don't. We can only bet or guess, but they have certainty. So that's the real insider information problem. But there are some good articles on this. Henry Manny wrote some good articles on insider information, and there've been some in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics too, if you want to read up on it. But I think it basically makes the stock market work faster. And in fact, that was always one of the critiques of markets, that, well, yeah, we understand this equilibrium story, you know, when demand shifts, you go from one equilibrium to another, but it can take a long time, and there can be unemployment and blah, blah, blah. And then when markets work faster like this, they say, oh, insider information, we need to put these people in jail who make markets work faster now. So no matter what happens to markets, prices go up, prices go down, they work slow, they work fast. The anti-market ideologues will come up with some excuse to complain about markets and freedom. It's, they don't trust us to live our lives and buy and sell from each other without their guidance. That's really what it's all about. That's really what totalitarianism is. Somebody who just can't stand to let other people live their lives in peace. That's what a totalitarian is. And just look at every member of Congress with the exception of Ron Paul, and you'll know what I'm talking about. I think our time is up. I have 2 minutes left.